Today is the 12th month, the 29th day of the month, so making it the last day of our biblical year as well as the last day of this week. Also, it's the last day of the 12th month, and we're going to be getting ready starting tomorrow, first day of the new moon, covering more subject matter pertaining to New Year's and Abib, Passover time, and things that pertain to the first month. So this will be the last Bible study on the book of Judges in order until we get into the second month. And then we'll pick back up when we have no other messages to cover. But we ended off on our last Bible study in the middle of chapter 3 of Judges at the story of Ehud. We finished up with a story about a man named Othniel, who we first saw as the judge, the first judge of Israel, after the time of Joshua. And it tells us that the Spirit of Yahweh came upon him, and he judged Israel, and he helped to deliver the people, and gave them rest, it says, for 40 years. So, for 40 years, the children of Israel had rest, and then, in verse 12, we're told about a great warrior named Ehud. And it says, "The children of Israel did evil again in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of Yahweh." So, once again, the reason for Israel's enslavement, their spoiling, if you go back to what we read prior, it calls it a spoiling, and the need for a judge, which once again in Hebrew means to clarify, the need for a clarification process to happen is because Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh, and in doing evil, that's the reason God always sends an enemy or sends some sort of enslavement, bondage against Israel. To clarify things again, they need a judge. 13 goes on to say, "He gathered unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and he went and he smote Israel, and he possessed the city of palm trees." Once again, the city of palm trees refers to the ancient nation of Phoenicia, or the place of Phoenicia, which seems as if it was a different cities along the coast in Palestine. And in this case here, we have two enemies that have come together in order to fight Israel with Moab. And the two enemies are Ammon, which we know is the brother of Moab. Ammon and Moab were brothers. But then we have a third one that we should be familiar with due to our study a couple weeks ago on the day of Purim, which is Amalek. Amalek has joined in Ammon and Moab's fight against Israel this time, and they were gathered against him to help destroy him. And once again, Amalek is the grandson of Esau on the Canaanite side of the family, and he seems to have become the principal tribe, if you will, or clan, whatever it was called, nation of the people of Esau, of Edom. And we're told that they smite Israel and they possess the city of palm trees, which we've also covered in the past. So at this time then, these three enemies of Israel are gathered together and they're warring. And it's also interesting to note that all three of these enemies would have been people who were unmarriable by Israel. They're all part of forbidden lineages that Israel was told that they could not mingle with. Okay? Ammon and Moab were forbidden in Deuteronomy chapter 23, and Amalek, being a descendant of Esau through his Canaanite side, would be forbidden by Genesis chapter 28. So we have three people who have reason to dislike Israel for that reason alone. 14 goes on to say, "The children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. But when the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh, Yahweh raised them up a deliverer," or a judge, "Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a man left-handed, and by him the children of Israel sent a present unto Eglon, king of Moab." pretty sure that this is said tongue-in-cheek, okay, that this they sent a present unto Eglon, the king of Moab, because it's not really a present after all. But it seems as if whoever's writing this was saying this in kind of a facetious kind of way. The alternative translation, I find this interesting for alternative study, is that in the alternative translation of Gera, the name of Ehud's father is the son of Gemini. So I think that that's kind of interesting. And the alternative translation also, we're told, is, and this is just a common King James alternative translation, is he's a man shut of his right hand. So they didn't refer to a left-handed people in the way we do. Biblically, they referred to someone as not being right-handed. So right-handed was seemingly the dominant warrior in that day, the dominant person, because everything references the right hand. 16 goes on to say, Ehud made him a dagger which had two edges, so a double-edged sword or a double-edged dagger, and it's of a cubit length. Now this time a cubit would be about the length of a man's wrist to his elbow thereabout, or from his fingertips to his elbow, depending on which type of cubit we're referring to. So it would be measured by his own cubit. And it's double-bladed for one purpose, to give a present to the king. It says, he did gird it under his raiment upon his right thigh, so that he could reach across himself and grab it, obviously. And he brought the present unto Eglon, king of Moab, and Eglon was a very fat man. And when he had made an end to offer the present, he sent away the people that bear the present. But he himself turned again from the quarries that were by Gilgal, and he said, I have a secret errand unto thee, O king, who said, keep silent. And all that stood by him went out from him. So apparently all these different leaders of different peoples came and gave obeisance to the king. They gave him some form of gift, which is probably the tax money that was due, whether it was crops or gold or silver or whatever, flocks and herds. All these things were paid to kings that subdued others, and they brought them willingly. That's how you knew who was willingly subject to another power, was if they would bring it personally to the king, or whether you would have to take it by force. So obviously the people of Israel as a whole brought these presents to the king, and probably other nations that he conquered as well. But whenever Ehud came to say he had something else to say to him, he had an errand, something that was special just for the king, Ehud must have respected him enough, or had him as one of his counselors, or had him in some kind of esteem, enough that he was willing to stay in a room all by himself with Ehud. So, something to learn about when people are in captivity, how they sometimes act whenever aggression is being used against them and they're looking for a way out, a biblical way. And Ehud came unto him, and he was sitting in a summer parlor, which he had for himself alone, it says. And Ehud said, I have a message from God unto thee. And he arose out of his seat. So now Ehud is saying, this message I have, it's not just a special message, it's a message from God. So Ehud apparently respects this enough to think, oh, wow, this guy has something to tell me that God's told him, or a priest or a prophet or somebody, and I want to hear it. So Ehud put forth his left hand, and he took the dagger from his right thigh, and he thrust it into his belly. And the heft also went in after the blade. That's the part that protects your hand on a dagger, that's fatter above your knuckles. And the fat closed upon the blade so that he could not draw the dagger out of his belly, and the dirt or dung came out. Then Ehud went forth through the porch, and he shut the doors of the parlor upon him, and he locked them. So he gave himself time to run away, we're being told. So So he escapes out of the summer parlor. He shuts the place up, makes it look like the king, Ehud, or Eglon rather, is in there by himself. And then he escapes, giving himself time to get away. And we're going to see here soon why. Israel's apparently waiting for a signal to let them know that this present has been delivered to the king, when this is indeed the original intent of the present. So it says in 24, when he was gone out, his servants came, and when they saw that, behold, the doors of the parlor were locked, they said, surely he covers his feet in the summer chamber. Now, I'm not trying to be distasteful to explain this, but there's something going on here in idiom that we don't really understand. And we'll get to that in just a second. It says, they tarried in 25 until they were ashamed, and behold, he opened not the doors of the parlor. Therefore they took a key, and they opened them, and behold, their Lord was fallen dead on the earth. Okay, what I was talking about was when it tells us that he was covering his feet in the summer chamber, or they supposed that he was doing this, that is a Hebrew idiom for using the restroom. Okay, to cover one's feet is referring to the gown that the person would have wore and how they would have had to squat or something to that effect, according to books that deal in this time frame and common sense. And then also the smell, which we're told specifically that the dirt or dung came out of Ehud, which if anybody's ever butchered an animal, they know if they cause that to happen that a pretty raw odor comes from it. And so it was kind of a perfect situation that Ehud left the palace in so that the servants, who were dealing, of course, with a very fat man, may have just been in there in private, you know, using the restroom, so to speak. And they waited, it tells us, until they became ashamed. So Ehud used a perfect execution of his plan, or, you know, of his battle, to bide the amount of time he needed so that he could effect this victory for Israel, which I think we can see from this and we can see from other things here in the future, that when we're told about the judges that God chooses, he generally doesn't choose dumb men. He chooses somebody who has something to offer God's kingdom. Something, you know, whether it's smarts or strength or wit or whatever it is, the judges are generally the type of people who can affect this deliverance for Israel. And Ehud seems to be just that kind of man. But we miss a lot of that if we just read through it and don't ask questions. So after the men tarried until they became ashamed, we are told that they find their Lord dead. He's laying there on the ground. And Ehud escaped while they tarried, while they wouldn't come into the house. And he passed beyond the quarries, and he escaped unto Sarath. And it came to pass that when he was come, that he blew a trumpet in the mount of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mount and before them. And he said to them, follow after me, for Yahweh has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. And they went down after him, and they took the fords of Jordan towards Moab, and suffered not a man to pass over. And they slew of Moab at that time about 10,000 men, all lusty and all men of valor, and there escaped not a man. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years. So at this time we have a 60-year rest that happens afterwards. So once the leader, the judge, the deliverer, was able to clarify Israel's situation before them, that there was nothing wrong with them rebelling against their enemies, and he led this, and he told the people, apparently, or the people knew what was happening, we're not really told how that happened, that this fight was going to, had already occurred between him and Ehud. He kind of put them in a situation, Eglon and Ehud were in a situation that caused the two nations to go to war. One way or the other, Israel was going to pay. Most likely they would have just made Ehud pay, or his family, but it could have gone much further. We're not exactly sure how far it would have went, but this put Israel in a situation where they wanted to fight. Now there's a little bit of a confusion here, whether or not the men who are lusty and men of valor are the men of Israel or the men of Moab. I'd say it was probably the Moabites in verse 29. And it's trying to make the point that there was 10,000 strong warriors, good men, that had no need to fall before Israel. They should have won the battle. And what it's trying to tell us is that Yahweh, once again, was with them, just like they were helped prior. They were being helped this time again, like in the days of Othniel. It says in 31, after him there was Shamgar the son of Anath, which slew of the Philistines 600 men with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel. Now we're not even told the situation about this, we're just simply told that seemingly right around the same time as this happened between Ehud and Eglon in the battle between Moab and Israel, Shamgar, then, in his section of Israel, also caused a delivery from the Philistines to occur. And so, what can we learn from Ehud and Eglon's story? I think we've covered quite a bit about it, but I think one thing that needs to be considered is good planning. Good planning. Anytime this type of situation is going to occur, Yahweh is not looking for some miracle always to use to free people. He's looking for people who are willing to free themselves. And Ehud definitely showed himself. Not only was he a left-handed warrior, which in many cultures, even in English culture and most European cultures, a left-handed person was not considered as skilled as a right-handed person. And so I think when Yahweh sometimes chooses a left-handed person, he's using the idea that deliverance can come from wherever he decides, and that on top of that, men sometimes, when they see a left-handed person, if there is that stigma attached to it, they are not expecting that type of attack from that kind of person. Even though we're told many times that the Benjamites specifically had left-handed warriors among their ranks that seemed to be used to confuse the enemy. So I think that that's something all that we can draw out of there in battle planning, in ideas of how God, whether it's spiritual or physical, warfare, that men need to be the type of people who are willing to do the job and do the job well. Do it the way God wants it done, but also be willing to contribute themselves as much as necessary. Ehud put himself in quite a bit of a predicament by attempting what he attempted. In chapter 4, we're going to cover the subject of Deborah, or the story of Deborah, which I think is pretty well known by most people. But we're told of a 60-year period of time where Israel had peace. And we know that Shamgar is grouped in with Ehud's story because it says in chapter 4, verse 1, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of Yahweh when Ehud was dead. So we know that Ehud's the main focus and that Shamgar was kind of a side judge who was alive in the same time period. And Yahweh sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, that reigned in Hazor. The captain of whose host was Sisera, which dwelt in Harosheth of the Gentiles, or of the nations. The word there is the same word generally referenced Gentile goy, or goyim, in this case, in the Hebrew. So it's dealing with a section of land that belonged to these kings that they referred to as Harosheth of the nations. And the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh, for he had 900 chariots of iron and 20 years he mightily oppressed the children of Israel. So we're told about these chariots of iron, the 900 chariots of iron, because it's a signification of not only the strength, but the sophistication, or the, you know, intelligence, the wisdom, the abilities of these kings. They're not dealing with some sheep herders in a no-name village. They're dealing with people who had the ability to make chariots out of iron, which is a status to be considered. So when we start this story, we're being told mainly that Israel's enslaved to a very strong people. They aren't enslaved to somebody who's weak and doesn't know anything about anything. These are men of war. Nobody makes 900 chariots out of iron unless they're warriors. They have the purpose of conquering other people. Chariots are made for invasion. They're not made for defense. 4 says, "And Deborah the prophetess, who was the wife of Lippidoth, she judged Israel at that time, and she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment." Now, once again, we have to go to our understanding of judge, because this is a common misunderstanding. Deborah, which literally her name means bee, as in the insect that flies around and makes honey, Deborah is a woman, and she's the first and one of the only women of this status that is in the Bible. But the type of judge that she is needs to be remembered. She's not the same type of judge that we deal with in the book of Exodus, for instance, among the elders of the men, that judgment was brought to decide if someone was going to be put to death. But rather, she is a clarifier. And in this case, she's a prophetess also, which we have several examples in Scripture of female prophetesses. We have some, I believe, in the time of Hosea. Josiah, I'm sorry. Time of Josiah. We have some in the time of the book of Acts. And we have others throughout the Scripture that are just named here and there. But it's not unusual to see. And we know that Yahweh chooses women as prophetesses. But we're also told something special about Deborah here. She is the wife of Lippidoth. And what that tells us is that she was a woman in subjection to her husband. She's not running around doing her own thing, but that she is still recognized as being a man's wife. She's a married woman. Okay, and so this also takes away from a common stigma that we have from our Catholic side of Christianity that equates saints and prophetess women to being virgins and women who've never been married. Okay, in this case, we have one of the first ones other than Miriam, Moses' sister, that's mentioned as being a married woman. Okay, so she judges or clarifies for Israel at this time. And she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah, or of the bee. I think it's kind of an interesting way to look at it when you consider her name, the two aspects of that insect. 6 goes on to say, "And she sent and she called Barak, the son of Abinom, out of Kadesh Naphtali, and said unto him, Hath not Yahweh, the God of Israel, commanded, saying, Go and draw towards Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and of the children of Zebulun?" So we have a place where this is occurring. We know that we're dealing with two tribes specifically of Naphtali and Zebulun. "And I will draw unto thee," Deborah says, "to the river Kishon, Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude, and I will deliver him into thine hand. And Barak said unto her, If thou will go with me, then I will go. But if thou will not go with me, then I will not go." So we see that this man Barak, he is only willing to fight the war, a man of war, is only willing to fight if this woman prophet goes along with him. Now, you have to consider that when you hear Deborah's response to this. 9 it says, "And she said, I will surely go with thee. Notwithstanding, the journey that thou takest shall not be for your honor. For Yahweh shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." And Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. So the man Barak is willing to go as long as Deborah goes, but Deborah gives him warning, and this is something that needs to be considered, because this is a judgment out of God's law. If you were to look into the blessings and the curses found in Leviticus as well as in Deuteronomy, you'll see that when the roles are reversed between men and women, that it's a judgment upon Israel. And in this case, we obviously have a similar situation as we have going on today, where we have men who are afraid to go to battle unless they have a woman with them. Now, in this case, it may have been because Deborah was a godly woman, and she had Yahweh on her side and had a closer relationship with him. So he thought, well, if we bring her with us, she will talk to God for us and get us out of trouble. So there's also that option. But what she tells him is that if I go with you, then the victory is going to belong to a woman. And I'm sure Barak thought to himself, well, he's talking about her. The glory was going, the glory of the battle was going to be sold, it was going to be given to Deborah because she went along. And in 10 it says, Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and he went up with 10,000 men at his feet. And Deborah went up with him. Now Heber, the Kenite, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent unto the plains of Zenaim, which is by Kadesh. And they showed Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, was gone up to Mount Tabor. And Sisera gathered together all his chariots, even 900 chariots of iron. And all of the people that were with him from Harosheth of the nations unto the river of Kishon. And Deborah said unto Barak, Up, for this day is the day in which Yahweh hath delivered Sisera into thine hand. Is not Yahweh gone out before thee? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor, and 10,000 men after him. And Yahweh discomfited Sisera and all his chariots and all his hosts with the edge of the sword before Barak, so that Sisera lighted down off of his chariot and fled away on his feet. But Barak pursued after the chariots and after the hosts unto Harosheth of the Gentiles, and all the hosts of Sisera fell upon the edge of the sword, and there was not a man left. Howbeit, Sisera fled away on his feet to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. So obviously these men even knew each other. And in knowing each other, there was a friendship or a league that was between them, that they would not harm one another. They did not consider these Kenites to be Israelites, even though they are technically part of Israel by extension, because they're married into Moses' family. And that's how they got to be where they are. And Jael went out to meet Sisera, and said unto him, Turn in, my lord, turn in to me, fear not. And when he had turned in unto her, into the tent, she covered him with a mantle. He said to her, Give me, I pray thee, a little water to drink, for I am thirsty. And she opened a bottle of milk, and gave him drink, and covered him. Again he said unto her, Stand in the door of the tent, and it shall be when any man does come and inquire of thee, and say, Is there any man here? Thou shalt say, No. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent, and she took a hammer in her hand. She went softly unto him, and she smote the nail into his temples, and fastened it into the ground. For he was fast asleep and weary, so he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said unto him, Come, and I will show thee the man whom thou seekest. And when he came into her tent, behold, Sisera lay dead, and the nail was in his temple. So God subdued on that day Jabin the king of Canaan before the children of Israel. The hand of the children of Israel prospered and prevailed against Jabin the king of Canaan until they had destroyed Jabin king of Canaan. So, going over this story here a little bit for clarity's sake. When Sisera came and fled and came to Heber's household, he was coming to a friend's house. Now, the Kenites, if we remember from our biblical history, they were a family to Moses' family by marriage, and they severed themselves, decided to no longer live among their own people. We're also told that they were Midianites. So we know that these Midianites, and I think we can safely see that that is the branch of the family it is, because Heber is the same as Hebrew, and there's also a Heber out of Shem's genealogy where we get our name Hebrew from. So we can be sure that these were Hebrew people that were dwelling among Israel, most likely spoke the same language, but they lived differently. They had no inheritance in Israel because they were not of the children of Israel, so they would be the strangers. Okay, whenever we read in the scripture multiple places and it tells us about the stranger that sojourns among you, these are the types of strangers we're talking about. These would be Midianite, Kenite strangers related to Israel, but not Israelite people. And so when Yahweh is talking about different laws that pertain to different peoples that dwell among Israel, but yet have no inheritance, this is the specific type of people we're talking about. All right. Sometimes it's wanted to extend unto cursed lineaged people that dwelt in Israel. Now, I'm not going to say that a Moabite, an Ammonite, an Edomite, and all those guys could not come and worship before the temple. They definitely weren't going to enter it. Not even an Israelite entered the temple. But they could certainly worship the God of Israel during times of peace. I'm not going to question that. But when we're talking about Passover observation, or when we're talking about other types of, we'll call them rituals out of the law, parts of the law that require a person to be an Israelite to perform them, and it also tells us, and of the strangers, these are the strangers we're dealing with, okay? And there's a reason this needs to be mentioned, because oftentimes it's forgotten about, and it's made to seem as if that stranger applies to the entire world. Okay, the entire world did not sojourn in Israel. There were specific strangers that sojourned in Israel. Okay, they lived there. They traveled among them. They lived among them. They worked among them. But they were not Israelites. It's very important to remember this. However, because of the idea that Israel was the chosen people of God, which was undoubtedly true, the stigma that they were outsiders prevailed. It was definitely still considered to be that way. And when Jabin came to these people, he considered the Kenites and these Midianite people to be friendly towards the Canaanites. They were not at war with one another. So he thought he was going to a place of peace. Now, Jael had to make a choice, and she obviously made a quick choice. Was she going to be an Israelite by custom, by law, while not racially being an Israelite, or was she going to be another people, a stranger? This was one of those decisions where she didn't have to make the one she made. She could have left herself to have allowed him to come and go and done nothing about it and used excuses. Well, I'm a woman, what'd you expect me to do? But she didn't. She made the choice to aid God's people. And I think there's a precedent here about the strangers, and remember the type of stranger I'm talking about, or particular, that are part of Israel, that this is the mentality that still is required of a stranger. that the benefit of Israel and the benefit of God's people and the benefit of Yahweh, this was God's war. It was not Israel's war. It was God's war. God told Barak to go and to smite the people and take Zebulun and Naphtali with them. That was God's command. It was not just a decision somebody made. So she had a choice to whether she was going to help Yahweh or whether she was not going to help Yahweh, whether Yahweh was going to be her God or not. So I think that's important to consider. And we also see strategy here, just like we saw in Ehud's execution of his plan. The strategy was, he says, give me something to drink. Sisera says, give me something to drink. Give me water. And instead, she gives him milk, which everybody knows that milk can help put you to sleep, especially when you're tired. And furthermore, it doesn't really quench your thirst all that well. So she kind of put him in a state of more drowsiness by giving him milk, maybe saying, well, I don't have any water right now. This is going to have to do, because she wants him to stay, or he wants her to stay, rather, at the door of the tent. So she uses a little bit of strategy here as well, knowing that she's planning to do something. And as soon as he had gone to sleep, she didn't go search around for a sword or a spear or a perfect weapon. She obviously knew how to nail a tent down. That was probably part of her feminine duties due to her being a Kenite, which were tent-dwelling people that moved their tents around from place to place to feed their herds and their flocks. So she re-nails tents probably pretty frequently with her husband and with her children, if she has any. And so she knows that she can maybe not wield a spear, maybe she doesn't wield a sword all that well, but she knows that she can drive a nail into hard ground, which she must equate to being Sisera's head. So what happens? She nails him, fastens him to the earth, and the word of Yahweh comes to pass, but not in the way that Barak thought that it was going to happen. It didn't happen by Deborah. Deborah seemingly just sat somewhere during the battle. We're not told of anything that she did particularly, but that Jael gets the glory out of this battle. So chapter 5. Then sang Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, on that day, saying, so apparently it's a duet, praise ye Yahweh for the avenging of Israel. When the people willingly offered themselves, hear, O ye kings, give ear, O ye princes, I will sing unto Yahweh. I will sing praise to Yahweh, the God of Israel. Yahweh, when thou wentest out of Seir, when thou marched out of the fields of Edom, the earth trembled, the heavens dropped, the clouds dropped water. The mountains melted from before Yahweh, even Sinai from before Yahweh, God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were unoccupied, and the travelers walked through byways. The inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel until that I, Deborah, arose. That I arose a mother in Israel. They chose new gods. Then was war in the gates. Was there a shield or a spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? My heart is towards the governors of Israel that offer themselves willingly among the people. Bless ye Yahweh. I'm going to stop here and draw some attention to some of the things Deborah's singing. We're told that this particular part of the song is definitely Deborah's part. Okay, it says, I, Deborah, arose, and I arose a mother in Israel. She's somewhat parodying the song of Moses, where we're told about new gods that came newly up. It says, they chose new gods, then was war in the gates. So we know that Yahweh sent this destruction on Israel for doing evil, and now we know one of the evils that they were doing was choosing new gods again. A promise God told us about from the very beginning that he was going to visit on the people. There's also something pretty interesting about what Deborah says here regarding the men of Israel. And that's how she feels towards them, but she gives their character. She says, "Was there a shield or a spear seen among 40,000 Israel? My heart is towards the governors of Israel that offer themselves willingly among the people. Bless ye, Yahweh." I think it's a pretty common idea, and it's something that our day and age we're definitely lacking, is men that are willing to offer themselves in the service of Yahweh, and not just preaching and evangelizing and being a missionary in some foreign country that doesn't need you. But I'm talking about actually putting yourself in jeopardy like a martyr would. And in this case, in the place of warfare. She's saying that her heart goes out towards these men who willingly gave themselves. And then she says, "Bless ye Yahweh." I think that's a pretty important part of where an Israelite woman's perspective is supposed to be in the type of man that she's supposed to be looking for. The type of men that are not willing to give themselves for their nation, their family, their God, are not men at all, and they're not worth having. They're not the type of men that any person should want to marry their daughter to, for certain. But ultimately, it's the type of person that is not going to be respected by their wife if they're not willing to put themselves forward for the cause of their people. 10 goes on to say, "Speak ye that ride on white asses, ye that sit in judgment and walk by the way. They that are delivered from the noise of archers in the place of drawing water, there shall they rehearse the righteous acts of Yahweh, even the righteous acts towards the inhabitants of his villages in Israel. Then shall the people of Yahweh go down to the gates. Awake, awake, Deborah, awake, awake, utter a song." This is obviously Barak's part of the song. "Arise, Barak, and lead thy captivity captive, thou son of Ahinom. Then he made him that remaineth have dominion over the nobles among the people. Yahweh made me have dominion over the mighty. Out of Ephraim was there a root of them against Amalek. After thee, Benjamin, among thy people, out of Maker came down governors, and out of Zebulun, they that handled the pen of the writer. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah, even Issachar, and also Barak. He was sent on foot into the valley. For the division of Reuben, there were great thoughts of heart. Why abode thou among the sheepfolds to hear the bleating of the flocks? For the division of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Gilead abode beyond Jordan, and why did Dan remain in his ships? Asher continues on the seashore and abode in his breeches. Zebulun and Naphtali were a people that jeopardized their lives unto the death in the high places of the field. The kings came and fought, then they fought the kings of Canaan and Tanakh. By the waters of Megiddo they took no gain of money." So, I think in some ways, I've heard it said in these writings here, the glory of like the wise men of Israel, the wisdom of Israel, how it's referencing Zebulun, who handled the pen of the writer. You know, he was eloquent in writing, and Dan was in his ships, and Issachar was on foot in the valley, and Reuben had thoughts of his heart. You know, these are like Renaissance type times in Israel. But really, what we're being told, if you consider the context, is Deborah's actually looking down upon the dainty men of Israel from the other tribes who sat at home, wrote books, and thought about things. You know, as a friend of mine used to say, they pontificated their navel. You know, the thinking of people who think they're meditating upon something great, like Renaissance men may be thought to be doing, while she's saying, but the men of Zebulun and the men of Naphtali, they jeopardized their lives. Some people were writing about things. Some people were talking about things. Some people were thinking about things. Some men died for freedom. And that's pretty much the idea that's being conveyed in this song at this point. And I think that's something to consider. And she also goes out of her way, or he, because it seems to me that this is probably Barak's part of the song, that what is being said next, that, and by the way, they didn't do it for spoil. They made no money off of this battle. They jeopardized their lives just simply to be free. They fought from heaven. The stars in their courses fought against Sisera. So this is a way of saying we obviously had help from Yahweh. The constellations even fought for us. The river of Kishon swept them away. The ancient rivers, the ancient river Kishon. O my soul, thou hast trodden down strength. Then were the horse hooves broken by the means of the prancings. The prancings of their mighty ones. Curse ye Meroz, said the angel of Yahweh. Curse ye bitterly the inhabitants thereof. Because they came not to the help of Yahweh. To the help of Yahweh against the mighty. Blessed above women shall Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, be. Blessed shall she be above women in the tent. He asked water, and she gave him milk. She brought forth butter in a lordly dish. She put her hand to the nail, her right hand to the workman's hammer. With the hammer she smote Sisera, she smote off his head. When she had pierced and struck through his temples, I guess a part of what she did that was left out of the original story, after she had smote him to the ground, she took his head off. At her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay down. At her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell down dead. I'm sure there's a way to make that sound much more melodic. The mother of Sisera looked out at a window and cried. Now this seems like this had to have been Deborah's part, because only I think a woman would have thought about this. The mother of Sisera looked out at a window and cried, through the lattice, why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the wheels of his chariot? Her wise ladies answered her, yea, she returned answer to herself. Have they not sped? Have they not divided the prey? To every man a damsel or two? To Sisera a prey of divers colors, a prey of divers colors. Of needlework, of divers colors of needlework on both sides, meet for the necks of them that take the spoil. So let all thine enemies perish, O Yahweh, but let them that love him be as the sun when he goes forth in his might. And the land had rest 40 years. So we're told that in the end of this song here, kind of a reflection, a poetic way of writing the song, if it was a sung song with instruments and all that, I don't think anybody could be sure. But you definitely see a lot of poetry and a lot of thought. A contrast between the weak and the strong, a contrast between those who should have won and those who won, a contrast between Israel, who has Yahweh as their God, at the end of the song, and how they went after other gods. They chose new gods at the beginning of the song. We also see quite a bit of imagery, better explanation of how certain things happened. And we also see that in Deborah's song, which I think is the only song in the book of Judges, that Jael is the victor. She's the one who actually won the battle for Israel, and she wasn't even an Israelite. I think we could probably be pretty sure that there was an Israelite man looking to marry her afterwards, or her children afterwards, rather, is what I meant to say, since the other would be unlawful. That her family probably did not lack trying to become Israelite after this. So that's going to conclude this study, and we will pick back up next Sabbath once we are out of the first month.